on Focus. Welcome to everyone joining us today on New Mexico PBS and listening at KUNM 89.9. This is live coverage of Governor Susana Martinez's 2016 State of the State Address. The governor will take the stage in just a couple seconds to lay out her legislative priorities for this year's 30-day session. Right after that, we're going to have four former lawmakers with us to discuss their reaction to it. We'll continue with that on KUNM 89.9. The governor is proposing a $6.46 billion budget this year. That's an increase of 3.7%, or roughly $228 million from the previous year. She calls that budget proposal quite cautious. That's in comparison, the LFC has proposed a $6.5 million budget, not too far apart from each other. But with those priorities of the budget, safety, education, and jobs, the governor is going to lay out her priorities for the 2017 legislative session. And again, we'll be having live analysis and feedback from four former lawmakers that are going to join us here in the studio. We'll carry that live on 89.9 KUNM as well. We'll be here with Janice Arnold Jones, former Republican state representative, Dee Dee Feldman, former Democratic state senator, and there's Governor Martinez.
Lieutenant Governor, Senate President Pro Tem, Mr. Speaker, Democrat and Republican leaders, esteemed members of the New Mexico legislature, Congresswoman Michelle Lujan Grisham, Congressman Steve Pierce, honorable members of the judiciary, former New Mexico governors, tribal governors, Archbishop John Wester, distinguished guests, the state's first gentleman, my husband Chuck Franco, the state's first newlyweds, Carlo and Tara. My adorable sister, Letty. And my fellow New Mexicans, it is an honor to join you for the Senate, for the State of the State Address, and open this legislative session, where our call and purpose will be to confront violent crime, demand more than mediocrity in education, and compete for jobs with the resolve that is expected of us. These challenges, these realities, are not specifically of our making. In some cases, they've been decades in the making. But this is what's in front of us. And for the sake of future generations, it is our responsibility to address them. Two of my guests today are here because for them and for their families and for the community around them, 2015 brought unthinkable personal pain and horrific tragedy. I grew up the daughter of a police officer, and as you know, Chuck was a police officer. And I remember at times not being able to reach him by phone, wondering if he was okay, always knowing there was a chance he might not come home. I cannot imagine and will not pretend to understand the pain and sadness that engulfed Julie Benner and Michelle Webster when that nightmare, something the spouse of every officer fears, became a reality. Officers Nigel Benner and Dan Webster served with distinction in the armed forces, volunteered in their communities, raised their families amongst us. They chose service to each of us and to sacrifice their safety for each of us. Heroes to strangers. Where most would run away from trouble out of fear, they would run toward it out of duty with courage. We will never understand why the tragic deaths, the senseless murders of these two heroes occurred. And maybe we aren't supposed to understand it. But I do know this. We are supposed to recognize men and women like Officers Benner and Webster. We are supposed to hold them up, to honor them, to encourage their exceptionalism in others, to tell our kids to be like them and serve like them. Julie and Michelle, your husbands showed each of us the highest and purest form of love. There is no greater expression of love for your neighbor than to be willing to lay down your life for them. And I know that their sacrifice was and remains your sacrifice as well. As a state, we pray for you and your families, and we recognize you for the courage and poise you've shown through unthinkable tragedy. May your husbands rest in God's true peace. Thank you for being with us today. As we start this session, this is not the backdrop we asked for, but it's the reality we face. Call them boomerang thugs or turnstile thugs, whatever. We have vicious, heinous criminals among us who are willing to take the lives of our greatest heroes and who have no business being out on our streets. We see teens terrorizing neighborhoods late at night. We still see drunk driving tragedies on our roadways. Innocent New Mexicans like Roberto Mendez, Sergio Mendez Aguirre, Grace Sinfield, and 19-year-old Jacob Salazar, all taken too soon. Often by repeat offenders who are still driving their deadly weapons on our roads. And communities, parents, and families ask, how are these criminals still out there? The public's frustration is not misplaced. Our laws are too lax, our justice system too weak, particularly when it comes to violent, dangerous offenders. It's our job to fix it, and there's a lot we can do. Every judge should have real-time access to the criminal background and history of defendants who appear in their courtrooms so that sentencing and bail decisions can be made with that information. And we need to amend our Constitution to allow judges to keep the most dangerous criminals in jail without bail. Because stories like Joseph Jaramillo's are too familiar. Jailed for aggravated battery, an assault, child abuse, and being a felon in possession of a firearm, he was granted bail, sent back into Albuquerque's neighborhoods. 9 days later, he was ramming a deputy's car with a stolen truck, putting more lives in danger. With what we've seen this past year, there are no more excuses for light sentences and automatic bail for violent offenders. And we need laws that are tough in substance, not just in sound bites. Look at our three strikes law. Sounds tough, but it was worded so that it didn't mean anything. No one has ever been incarcerated under that law. Let's put real teeth into it, so we can keep those who commit repeated violent felonies who repeatedly prey on innocent families behind bars for life. In addition, skipping out on parole should be a fourth-degree felony, and I fully support the bipartisan effort to allow local communities to adopt curfews if it's necessary to keep us safe. With respect to ending DWI, I recently announced several major initiatives. Saturation patrols on our deadliest highways, targeting repeat offenders and the establishments that overserve them. A court monitoring program that will place citizens inside courtrooms in 5 counties to shed light on the criminal justice process and their outcomes. And an ongoing roundup of those with outstanding bench warrants for DWI crimes or repeat DWI offenders who have absconded from parole because of their unwillingness to take responsibility for driving drunk means they're likely to do it again. People like Danny Velarde, who was just recently captured, tried to evade justice after committing 6 DWIs and being convicted of voluntary manslaughter. Whether it's a citizen monitoring a courtroom or someone reporting that they saw one of our top 10 DWI absconders, or the college kid who risks being disliked because refusing to let his friend drive drunk, ending DWI in New Mexico involves each and every one of us. It's cynical and factually incorrect to suggest that our drunk driving laws are tough or anything like surrounding states. They're not. Those who repeatedly drive drunk need to face stiffer penalties, and so should those who knowingly toss in the keys to drive the car. Of course, protecting our communities also involves protecting our children. So that if they are exploited in child pornography, those who possess those images or videos should face the full weight and serious force of the law. But that's not happening in New Mexico, because our Supreme Court ruled that prosecutors no longer have the option to charge someone in possession of child pornography with multiple counts based on the number of images they have. They said our laws aren't clear enough to allow that, and rather than clarify it, some in the legislature have refused to act. Consequently, criminals like former APS kindergarten teacher Joshua Weitz, who allegedly possessed 40 child pornography files, was charged with only 1 count in November. And Juan Santos Torres, who possessed several videos, was sentenced to just 14 months in jail, a fraction of the time he should have served because of this loophole. That's not right. I agree with the Attorney General. We must close the child pornography loophole in New Mexico. We must also make protecting our families a key priority in the budget. I recognize that revenues are uncertain due to persistently low energy prices and that most agency budgets will have to be held flat. This means that with the limited new revenue we will have, we must prioritize more and better. Public safety should be at the top of that priority list. expand the use of family support workers who work with at-risk families who have a history of CYFD referrals in order to prevent child abuse. Clear the backlog of rape kits in New Mexico. Provide more officers with immediate access to child abuse case history before being dispatched to a child abuse call. And let's invest in expanding the ranks of our public safety workers and do more to retain them. That means hiring new state police officers, expanding the correctional unit that tracks down violent absconders, hiring more child abuse caseworkers to reduce their caseloads, and providing targeted pay raises for public safety workers who are on the front lines each day. If we do all these things to make New Mexico safer, we not only honor our public safety workers, show that we understand and respect the danger and sacrifice they face, we also honor the victims of the senseless violent crimes we've seen and their families who live with the pain of loss every day. This should motivate us to overcome any special interests or politics that stand in the way, to do what's right, to stand against those who thrive on creating fear and chaos. It's time to say, not here and not in New Mexico. Of course, combating crime also means working to prevent people from becoming criminals. This is a longer-term challenge, and a lot goes into it. Behavioral health can be one of many factors. Over the last 2 years, we've seen an 84% increase in behavioral health services provided in our state, to the highest level in state history. And under my budget, we will use additional behavioral health dollars for new crisis triage centers, mobile crisis response teams, and community behavioral health clinics. Education obviously plays an important role too, because it's an education that provides someone with hope that tomorrow can be better than today. I was a prosecutor for 25 years. I saw so many 15, 16, even 20-year-olds who could not read, had little hope that they'd ever find work, faced more challenges than opportunities in life, dropped out of school at some point, and turned to crime. You see, if we don't get this part right, if our kids don't learn to read, if we cannot graduate our students with basic knowledge and life skills, the ripple effects in their lives, in their children's lives, and in society are potentially enormous. No child is unteachable. I will never give up on any kid. Every child can learn. Our reform agenda is clear. First, every child needs to read at an early age so they can learn every year thereafter. Under my plan to give our kids the best start possible, we'll expand pre-K, which has tripled so far on my watch, and build $5 million worth of new pre-K classrooms throughout the state of New Mexico. And we'll add $10 million in new reading interventions specifically for students in chronically struggling schools. Second, we need a quality teacher in every classroom. Teachers, they matter. When they succeed, we should honor them. And when they struggle, we should help them. To build a stronger recruitment pipeline, I ask the legislature to raise the minimum starting teacher salary to $36,000 per year, which would total a 20% increase over the last 4 years. expand the loan repayment program for teachers, and let's offer dozens of scholarships each year to our brightest college students, $15,000 apiece, if they enter a college of education in their junior year and commit to teaching in New Mexico. And to better support our teachers, we should provide our most effective with additional pay. Provide debit cards to help teachers cover the cost of classroom school supplies, and expand our new teachers' mentoring program to give teachers who struggle help from their peers. Third, students should never be trapped in failing schools. And because we have a meaningful school grading system, we know where those schools are. The teacher mentorship program I just mentioned is modeled after a similar principal mentoring effort called Principals Pursuing Excellence. It's helping turn around struggling schools. In fact, after just 1 year, 53% of schools with participating principals saw their school grade increase by at least one letter grade. The next year, 60% saw grades improve in their first year. Associate Superintendent Arsenio Romero of Roswell and Principal Robin Cook of Cloudcroft are here today. This mentorship program, An Educator Helping an Educator, has helped Cloudcroft Middle School quickly improve its school grade from a C to an A. What a difference that makes for students. When we choose to reform and commit to reform, we see results. Thank you, Arsenio and Robin, for all that you have done. Principals need additional tools, like the ability to use adjunct teachers in our classrooms. Why not make it easier for a retired scientist from Sandia to teach math at a high school? And we must continue offering stipends to teachers who agree to teach difficult subjects, like math, science, or special education, in areas where recruiting these teachers is so challenging. Fourth, we must increase parental involvement. Make it easier for parents to be engaged in their child's education. In state government, we're now granting leave so employees can attend parent-teacher conferences. And I hope local governments and the private sector will follow suit. And finally, we need to graduate more of our kids from high school, ready for the workforce or college. Truancy is a key impediment to this. But now we have an early warning dropout prevention system that identifies at-risk students. That lets us put more social workers in middle schools to help these kids and dropout prevention coaches in high schools. But we need to get their attention with consequences they care about. If a kid stops going to school, they shouldn't get a license to drive a car. You know, contrary to what the status quo might say, improving education isn't about money alone. We're spending more on education than ever before, and we've also reduced time spent on state-mandated testing, and it will go down further this year. What matters is whether our kids are learning. We have to measure success, and if they're struggling, get them early help. What could possibly be more important? If they can learn in school, opportunities will follow in life. Reading skills are formed early on. As a result, if children are passed along in early grades when they cannot read, the likelihood of them being able to learn in later grades plummets. And people wonder why a large number of students in New Mexico don't graduate. If we accept failure early, if we implicitly tell a child they can't learn, why would we expect otherwise? And why would we allow ourselves to be shocked if these discouraged, frustrated students choose to drop out or turn to crime? It's not an excuse by any means, but they weren't required to have the most important tool in life, the ability to read. This is reality. Someone to ignore it, sacrificing the future opportunities of these kids, pretending that we're building their self-esteem. But let's be honest, it does nothing to help them feel better when they're called on to read in front of class, or when they take the SAT and can't read the questions, or when they can't fill out an application for a job. What do you think their self-esteem is like then? This is one of those moments. We have to confront reality or punt. We must end the practice of passing our students from grade to grade when they cannot read. Simply opposing this education agenda is not, in and of itself, an agenda. Saying we should stop grading schools, stop evaluating teachers, stop raising standards at colleges of education, stop targeting education dollars on reading coaches and school turnaround efforts, that's not an agenda. It's an endorsement of the status quo, and it props up mediocrity. If our children aren't learning, we are compelled to change, to be better, to set a higher standard. Why? So that our kids can succeed in life. Of course, it's also our responsibility to ensure there are jobs for our kids when they graduate, because we want them to work in New Mexico and raise their families here. This means attracting new jobs and businesses from elsewhere while creating conditions that encourage New Mexico companies to expand. We must never be so arrogant or naive to forget that businesses can locate anywhere in the world. Whether we like it or not, whether it makes us comfortable or not, we are in a high-stakes daily competition with other states and other countries. It's our job to make New Mexico more welcoming, more predictable for job creators, and we've come a long way in doing so, largely by focusing on the fundamentals to better compete. Working together, we've put state government on firm fiscal ground, balancing our budget each year without raising taxes. We've restrained government growth and built up a strong savings account. It hasn't been easy, I know. We had to overcome the largest structural deficit in state history, federal budget cuts, a federal government shutdown, and the steepest oil and gas price crash in decades. Energy prices continue to pose very real and concerning challenges. But our bipartisan work has sent a loud message to any business owner looking at New Mexico that we will not bail out government on the backs of hardworking families and job creators. We've also changed our regulatory attitude. Said it's possible to grow our economy and protect our environment and public health. We have assessed and collected more in fines against polluters than any other administration in state history. At the same time, we are increasing predictability and encouraging commerce. Drilling permits are issued in 8 days or less. Nurses who come to New Mexico are licensed in 5 days or less. We extended the overweight cargo zone at our border so that trucks can make fewer trips. And we now have independent hearing officers outside of the tax department to handle tax disputes so people can be confident they're getting a fair shake. With respect to building a stronger workforce, we are making important changes in higher education in order to graduate more students on time in the workforce areas our economy needs. Because a 14% four-year graduation rate is unacceptable. So is a 47% six-year graduation rate, especially when the national average is 69%. As experts have told us, our kids are taking too much time, taking too many credits, spending too much money, and ultimately not graduating. Consequently, entry into the workforce is delayed, students' debt is high, and we have too few college graduates. That's why universities are adopting tuition incentives for any student who graduates in 4 years and working to limit all degree programs to 120 credit hours. After all, if we expect students to graduate in 4 years, it has to be possible to do so. We're improving how credits transfer among institutions, providing better counseling, changing how majors are selected so that students don't waste time and don't waste money on unnecessary credits. Where these reforms have been adopted, we find incredible success. A 17-point jump in the four-year graduation rate at Florida State University and a 20-point jump at Georgia State. And as we graduate students more quickly, we have to ensure we are producing the degrees our businesses need so we don't end up exporting our college graduates or having to import workers from elsewhere. That's why I'm calling on the legislature to support the Students Work Internship Portal, which would allow any New Mexico business to post internships online through a shared website that our colleges and universities would use to connect students to these positions so that our students learn how to be a good employee, explore career paths, and so they stay right here in New Mexico when they graduate and get a job right here in our state. Together, we've also worked to develop key sectors of New Mexico's economy, like tourism, which benefits every corner of our state. Our New Mexico True advertising campaign is achieving tremendous results. We're seeing record numbers of visitors and increased tourism spending. Or our high-tech sector, where we've passed legislation to encourage research and development of cutting-edge products and expanded access to capital that so many startups need. For example, we just enacted last week a new effort to deploy up to $40 million in new early-stage investment capital in the partnership with the State Investment Council to help New Mexico companies get off the ground and grow. We put forth the state's first energy plan since 1991, calling for the increased development of every kind of energy we can produce in New Mexico. And we continue to make New Mexico a key corridor for international trade by building up our port at Santa Teresa and maintaining our place as a growing leader in exports and export-related jobs. Take all of this together. a stable state budget, workforce development reforms, a welcoming regulatory attitude, the development of key economic sectors. We're making great progress in these areas while also fundamentally changing our tax and incentive environment. 5 years ago, we had a poorly managed closing fund to recruit new companies with hardly any money in the account. We now require clawbacks to protect this money and have increased the size of our closing fund to $50 million. Our job training program helps businesses, large and small, urban and rural, expand and hire new workers. We've increased funding for this program and expanded the types of businesses that can access it. We cut our business tax rate by 22%, made it easier for exporting manufacturers to produce their goods in our state, curbed the double and triple taxation of goods and services in construction and manufacturing. Our tax rate on manufacturing has been cut by 60% to the lowest in the region, and our taxpayer friendliness score has soared from a D to a B, and we're nearing an A. My friends, the fundamentals are changing. Companies are taking note. Our recruitment pipeline is filling up as these reforms begin to take hold. New Mexico makes the final cut for larger and more projects than ever before. Take a company like Scorpios, a tech firm that is using photonics to revolutionize the way information is communicated and stored. They didn't have to choose to manufacture their technology in New Mexico, to hire 300 workers over the next 5 years with good, well-paying jobs. We had to compete for that. It's just a reality. In fact, Scorpio's founder, Stephen Krasulik, said we beat out Pennsylvania and Texas. Stephen Krasulik, we couldn't be happier that you chose New Mexico. We pray that your company will be a success and make a greater impact on the world than you could ever imagine before. Thank you. And then there's RiskSense, which has also committed to growing in New Mexico. They're on the cutting edge of cybersecurity services, a global problem. They didn't have to choose New Mexico either. But thanks to the work we've done to improve our tax and incentive climate, both of these companies are here to stay. Srinivas Mukamala, thank you. And Mark Fidel, RiskSense President and CEO also, are with us today. Thank you for putting your faith in our state. Of course, there's always more we can do and should do, like maintaining our $50 million closing fund or adopting tax reforms to encourage small business growth and attract veterans who want to open new companies or build a second career, or creating rapid workforce development fund, which would help us close recruitment deals that require a significant number of highly specialized trained workers, investing in Main Street projects, encouraging new development in key economic corridors of our cities and towns, and finally, ending the practice of requiring New Mexicans to join a union or give money to one just to have a job. These are all important, and they can help us maintain the momentum we've established as we fight for jobs and new investments. We shouldn't fear competition with other states. We should embrace it. I'm committed to winning that fight, and I hope you will stand with me to help create more New Mexico jobs. That's what we need to be working on. Though this is a short session, there are other important realities we face, other vital problems we should choose to address and not avoid, like fixing the way we spend infrastructure money, because the way projects are funded now leads to unmet regional needs and state needs and a string of projects that haven't been vetted and can't be completed. We should improve campaign finance reporting processes, close the revolving door between legislators and lobbyists, and require the disclosure of capital outlay allocations and any private clients served by public officials in New Mexico. And the legislature should finally listen to the people of New Mexico. Let's end the dangerous practice of giving driver's licenses to illegal immigrants from all over the world. You know, New Mexicans have been concerned about this years and years, long before contractors and workers faced extra hurdles trying to get into our federal facilities. New Mexico's been a target for human traffickers and smugglers seeking to take advantage of our laws. And now the federal government has confirmed its plan to stop accepting New Mexico driver's licenses to board airplanes. These our realities. Our license is not secure, and New Mexicans have repeatedly demanded a change in this law. Some have advocated just kicking the can down the road. That's getting much harder to do. Others want to continue giving preferential treatment to illegal immigrants at the expense of United States citizens. That's not common sense. It's not acceptable. And it ignores the will of the people who elected us. Our compromise is the same as surrounding states. It stops giving licenses to illegal immigrants from around the world, and it ensures our ID is secure. We've talked about it year after year, and this discussion has been had. It's time to solve this problem and vote. Before I close, I'd like to recognize a few extraordinary New Mexicans who embody what it means to serve and sacrifice for one another. Just a few weeks ago, we endured a massive statewide snowstorm with snowdrifts that reached 12 feet high, shutting down movement throughout much of New Mexico. It was dangerous, and conditions were life-threatening. Ty Gonzer and Bill Shear live and work in Clovis. Ty grew up being taught that when snowdrifts cover large objects, the drift can turn a blue color. So imagine white snow as far as the eye can see, no movement, no sound, and just happening to notice what looks like something slightly darker in the snow and wondering if something or someone might be underneath. That's what Ty did. He and Bill used heavy equipment to attack their hunch and a 12-foot snowdrift to uncover a car that had a couple in it who had been trapped for 20 hours. Ty says, We saw their faces after we pushed the snow away, and it's something I'll never forget. Ty and Bill. They won't forget how they felt when they saw your faces either. Helping one another, that's what New Mexico's about. Thank you for your instincts, your courage, and your sacrifice. And State Police Sergeant Jason Knapp, he rescued Francine Hoffman, a grandmother and college tutor whose car ran off the road and was trapped in the snow. She was exhausted, had been traveling from Washington, D.C., Francine called AAA, but they told her it would be hours before they'd be able to help. She was hungry and scared. You can imagine her sense of relief when Sergeant Knapp arrived. He spent a long time with Francine, even enlisting the help of volunteers as he personally drove her vehicle back to a safe place. Francine said that it was only by God's grace and Sergeant Knapp's gracious strength and encouragement that she made it. Sergeant Knapp, you volunteered to be a police officer, and part of that job is running toward the situations none of us want to be a part of. Thank you for the kindness and help you provided to help Francine. Job well done. These individuals exemplify the fighting spirit in our state, the desire to help people overcome and succeed. I think of the thousands who have attended vigils this year in mourning, following senseless tragedies, or those who have given of their time or money to help kids learn, to help victims make their way through suffering, or otherwise help those in need. We see the challenges around us, our neighborhoods, our families, our communities. We want to solve the problems and realities that face us. I believe we are capable of pulling together to prevent horrific loss in the hands of heinous criminals. We are capable of pulling together to ensure that every child gets a quality education and none are left without opportunities and hope. We are capable of pulling together to compete for jobs and new investment in every corner of our diverse state, because we have to do these things. Or the brighter tomorrow we all want for our kids is at risk of growing dimmer instead. I'm confident we can confront and overcome these realities together if we choose not to put them off a moment more. New Mexico's future depends on it and depends on us. God bless you. God bless all of New Mexicans and New Mexico. Thank you so much for all that you do for our citizens.
Governor Susana Martinez's 2016 State of the State Address. I'm Gene Grant, host of New Mexico in Focus. Welcome to everyone tuned in today through New Mexico PBS and online through our media partners or listening on KUNM and KUNM.org. What do you want to see from the governor and the legislature this year's 30-day session? Share your thoughts with our team by connecting with New Mexico in Focus on Facebook or Twitter. Now, I'm joined today by Janice Arnold Jones, former Republican state representative. Dee Dee Feldman, former Democratic state senator. Daniel Foley, Republican and former New Mexico House Minority Whip and regular on our show. And Eric Riego, former Democratic state senator. Thank you all for coming in today, a tradition for all of us. Daniel, let me start with you. Initial thoughts, initial impressions. I want to get this from everybody, and then we'll come back to some more detailed stuff.
Well, initial thought is show up on time. I mean, they start at noon, and the speech didn't start till almost 2 o'clock.
Right.
I think at some point,
that's,
you know,
fair.
You got to, I mean, if you want kids to watch it, if you want people to be part of it, I do think that once she got going, I mean, she outlined a pretty broad plan, a pretty wide plan for a 30-day session. Mm-hmm. You know, she touched on education, touched on jobs, touched on taxes, touched on the hot issue that's been the issue since she's been here, which is driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, took time to congratulate New Mexicans that stepped up and went above and beyond during the recent storms in New Mexico. So I actually think it's one of her better speeches that she's given since she's been governor.
Mm-hmm. Representative Janice Arnold Jones, thanks for coming in for us.
My pleasure.
Your thoughts, your initial thoughts.
I didn't see much new here. The governor has stayed very close to her campaign promises, mm-hmm. and she highlighted a few improvements. But basically, as a State of the State address, it said that we haven't gone very far. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the focus was on law enforcement, mm-hmm. and on public safety. And I agree with Dan. I think it was one of her better speeches, but I wanted more meat. I wanted to know where the money was, how we were going to do this. Mm-hmm. And I was looking for one other thing. 30-day sessions like this with the looming driver's license is tough. At some point, you need to start here and now to be persuasive to get the votes that you need. I'm still looking for it.
Interesting. I want to come back to that. Interesting. Senator Eric Riego, thanks for coming in. Your initial thoughts.
Well, what I heard was this real emphasis, kind of in her sweet spot, her comfort zone, which is, you know, punishment as opposed to investment. I didn't hear a lot about how we're going to solve these through investing in human capital. I didn't hear about, you know, much about the nominal investment in early childhood. I heard a lot of, there was a line there that I found shocking about teens, that somehow teens are part of teens sort of running, kind of running wild, I guess, in the city. I'm disappointed that immigrants continue to be sort of one of the scapegoated groups that had some rings of Trump-esque, let's identify groups like immigrants and teens and so on to sort of scapegoat. The other thing that was really disappointing is she talked a lot about economic development, but I was counting the paragraphs as something like 15 to 20 mentions of recruitment, out-of-state companies, investing, and only 2 mentions of companies, you know, most of the economy, most of the jobs, which are local companies. What are we going to do for them? So I think that externally driven economic development strategy, which I think, driven by tax cuts and lowering regulations is, frankly, is not working. I think Senator Feldman said earlier, where are the jobs?
Right. Interesting. And speaking of, Senator Dee Dee Feldman, thanks for coming in. Your initial thoughts.
Well, first of all, I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted by her rather overblown, very emotional approach without as much substance as I would have expected. Mm-hmm. I mean, we heard all about closing funds and tax breaks and workforce development, and from what you would hear there, it would seem like we were number one in job development, job creation. We are number one in unemployment. Mm-hmm. And that was just a disconnect for me. Mm-hmm. And I agree with Eric. There are no teens terrorizing neighborhoods in New Mexico.
My teenage kids yet.
I was envisioning groups of people roaming different neighborhoods. That's overblown.
Well, let me ask you a question. I'll stay with you, Senator Feldman, and we'll start on a couple of things here. The priority on public safety versus jobs, that was a discussion leading up to this. What was going to be the priority? Are you comfortable with the priority being on safety issues, or should it have been on jobs?
Well, I think they're both two things that are dragging us down as a state. So I think both of them should be in focus. Mm-hmm. And, we're really low on national report cards when it comes to crime, and we're low, as I said earlier, in terms of jobs. So we need to focus on both of them. I think that it's right to do that.
Dan Foley, let me ask you the same question. The emphasis on public safety issues. He used some anecdotes, some of them right from here in Albuquerque, that sent folks appropriately into some worry. Is she taking advantage of what's in the air right now to upend her priorities, or should this be the priority?
Well, I think what I thought was interesting, I think it should be a priority. Mm-hmm. Obviously, she's taking advantage of things that happen. She's a politician. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, that's what happens. But I think what I thought, which was kind of glazed over a little bit, but I've railed about for years now on New Mexico in Focus, is the role the New Mexico Supreme Court's playing in changing the laws in New Mexico by the way they decide to interpret something or the way they decide to rule on something. And I thought it was interesting to see a governor, who, by the way, is also an attorney, call the Supreme Court to task while they're sitting right there. But I think we got to remember that in line with the crime is the jobs, right? I mean, it's not a Republican, liberal, Democrat, conservative, doesn't matter. I mean, when the jobs are going up, crime goes down. I mean, people are working. People have the money coming in. And so you can't look at either one of these in a vacuum. You've got to say, look, there's no doubt. I don't think anybody sitting at the table is going to say, we don't have a crime problem in New Mexico. We clearly do. But as Senator Fetterman said, we also have a jobs problem. And so if we try to fix one of those independently of the other one, I think you're just destined to repeat what's been happening.
Janice Arnold Jones, interesting on Dan Foley's point just then. She did make aims to connect education to crime.
She did.
Was that credible for you? Did that work, that connection?
It was a little loose. I was still back in the, I'm really glad that you're focusing on literally incarceration, punishment.
Right.
But I didn't hear the other side. And if we go too far in terms of incarceration, A, I'm looking at the budget. Did we have enough money there?
Mm-hmm.
And B, after incarceration, there are another whole set of problems. No discussion. And so I worry about that, but there is a balance, because if you want to improve the economic climate, mm-hmm. crime is a factor. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so at what point do our laws mean things, whether it's in campaign finance or in DWI? When does it mean something? And I think she did correctly, but it was a little oblique, place it in the courts, because they need to act.
Interesting. Eric Grego, your response to that.
So I agree. The best crime fighter is a job, and often the best crime fighter is a really good education to give people opportunity. There was a lot of, token amounts. I'm certainly happy that there were some investments in some of these areas. But they're really dropping the bucket. I was looking at the number, just the corrections department budget is almost three times what the state is investing in early childhood. And again, this isn't a liberal conservative thing. Some of the most prominent conservative economists, James Heckman, Ben Bernanke, not folks exactly we consider wild-eyed liberals, have said the best bang for your buck, and we've said this on the show and I've seen it on the show, is to invest in early childhood. Yet she talked about token investments. This is a $6.5 billion budget, mm-hmm. and she's talked about a nominal $5 to $10 million increase in those. That's better than nothing, certainly.
Sure.
But if you want young people in particular to stay here and to have an opportunity and to be economically active, you have to invest in them. That human capital is very, very important. Mm-hmm. So you saw again, half the speech was about punitive measures. I don't know if the governor's been to the jail here at MDC lately. It's full, mm-hmm. and most of those people have issues of employment and literacy, which she pointed out in the speech. Yet we're not talking about what to do with the population. And by the way, anybody who's been up there sees how overrepresentative Native Americans, African Americans, mm-hmm. and Hispanics are in that jail, and they are, and all the statistics show that those. So it's great to say be tough on crime. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk a lot about how that's going to be implemented, and is that really the best way to get us out of this hole that we're in economically, mm-hmm. Or in terms of crime?
Interesting point there, Senator Feldman. One point that came up and went fairly quickly was behavioral health issues.
Yes, I was just going to mention that. Yeah, behavioral health mm-hmm. issues are at the root of many of these things. Mm-hmm. And although the governor has indicated that there's been more money spent on behavioral health, a lot of that is at the local level.
She says 84% increase in behavioral health services provided in our state to the highest level in state history.
I really have a hard time believing that.
The number
I really
of
have a,
okay.
And if it is being the highest amount spent, and it's in a very disorganized and ineffective way. I think you just ask anyone in that field, and they will tell you that.
Did you hear, Senator Feldman, did you hear a commitment on the governor's part to lean into behavioral health issues a little bit more? Did something come across to you that says she realizes this is one of the three legs of the stool, and we need to really prop this up. Because, again, it came and went with one paragraph.
No, I did not hear that commitment. And I did not hear, in the same fashion, that she mentioned increases in the early childhood budget as well. But I remember back, I think it was in 1998, in the wake of Columbine, when the entire legislature came together around this idea of ghosts from the nursery. The ghosts from the nursery, if they are not tended to, will result in increased juvenile crime. And this was taken from a book by Robin Carr Morse. And in the wake of that, the legislature began looking at home visiting programs in hopes of forestalling another Columbine. And gradually we've been doing it, but it's just a drop in the bucket so far. We need that kind of major offensive, that kind of Marshall program, in order to pull ourselves up from the bootstraps. And then we'll be addressing both the jobs problem and the crime problem.
Daniel Foley, let's go back to education for a quick, little more detail on that. What did you hear in the speech of the governor regarding education that gives you confidence that we're going to turn a bit of a corner here on this issue?
Well, I think a couple things. One of them is that she talks about the testing requirements going down even more, which has been a constant barrage of complaints from the classroom that we're spending too much time testing. So I feel like she's acknowledged that. She said, look, we've dialed it down some. We're going to dial it down even more. So I think that's showing that they're listening. I think, you know, the fact that she talks about during her watch that she's tripled the amount of pre-K. I mean, look, I understand people want more, but she's tripled it. I mean, it's more than any other governor's ever done. So, I mean, they're making a move to do it. The problem is there's so many problems with the budget that and just in education alone. And so I think there's some real movement. I'm the jury's still out on the driver's license deal. We were discussing that offline, some of us, but I get it. I mean, I think most kids would want to stay in school and try to get a diploma or a GED. If they're going to lose their driver's license. In the end, though, a lot of the stuff that she talked about was kind of platitudes. And what I get a little frustrated with, and this is going to upset some of my conservative friends, is I get upset with any of the governors, whether it's Republican or Democrat, that gives these speeches on platitudes and then leaves it to the legislature to fill it, but then disagrees with how they want to fill it. I mean, I think if you're going to say, we're going to fix education, here's five things I want, these five things are important to me, I don't care what else you do, but you're not getting it unless you give me these five. And every year, year after year, governors don't say that. They just say, we got to fix education, we got to fund pre-K, or we got to stop funding pre-K, whatever it is. But then they leave it up to the legislature. And I think it's time that we look for a governor, and I would like to see Governor Martinez. So the last 2 years of her administration, I think she missed an opportunity to step more up in this speech and say, here's my five things that I want from you to address education. And if you give me these five things, we'll be moving in the right direction. I think the state is lacking that leadership at any level right now, and it allows those that want to say, I don't have a plan, I just don't like your plan, to rise to a level of perceived leadership that I think is hurting New Mexico.
That's an interesting point. Janice Arnold Jones, please pick up on that.
I would say, as the other conservative in the room, I would like to disagree with my colleague, but I can't. You did good. You know, and this has been a refrain. I appreciate that the governor has said, you know, third grade has got to be the end time. We cannot pass students. But that has become rhetoric. And we want to fight about
it. Like being for education. Who's against it?
Yeah, no kidding.
Reading.
And when, in fact, reading is the key, I want to see measurable results of early reading intervention. Mm-hmm. We have done, when we first tapped the permanent fund, part of it was to deal with K-3-plus pre-K and K, and part of that should have been to measure whether or not our children are reading, in which case third-grade reading, holding them back, should not even be an issue. And because we are not doing the first part, we're talking about hot air. That part is very discouraging to me.
Eric Rago, please pick up on that.
Yeah, so I think Janice is talking about the K-3-plus program, which is really targeted to helping the kids who were in the toughest circumstances, having the biggest challenges. Again, it's not everybody's crazy about it, but it's a wonderful program. But when you say a million here or half a million there, it sounds like a lot of money. You know, we have about 30,000 kids per grade per year, And the access is the issue. The issue isn't that we have great, great programs. There's K-3 plus. We have a home visitation program in the state. We have a pre-K program. Mm-hmm. The problem is, in most cases, it's about 10% or less access to most of those programs. The one program that seems to be fully funded, not fully funded, but better funded, is these child care block grant funding, which is mostly federal money. We talk about how much we spend. Half of the money that we spend in total on early childhood comes from the federal government, and that's where we're helping people who need to have their kids in early childhood. I want to say two things real quickly, because I know I was very gloomy about this speech. Two things I want to say. This idea of the state employees and local employees in the private sector encouraging them to give parents time off to do parent teachers. As a parent, that's crucial. I really want to say that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. And also the on campaign finance, you know, to say that this kind of revolving door between legislators and lobbyists, I think the fact that we're going to try to push that again, and she supports that, I think those are two positive things. I don't want to say totally negative on the speech.
Listen, thank you all. We're going to have some web extra stuff. Stick around. We can't get to everything in the speech, so you can find that on New Mexico in Focus, newmexicopbs.org. And thank you for tuning in today to Susana Martinez's 2016 State of the State Address on New Mexico PBS and KUNM. Now, during this year's 30-day legislative session, New Mexico PBS, KUNM, New Mexico In-Depth, and the New Mexico Newsport will collaborate on coverage of ethics, accountability, and transparency in state government. If you want to hear more from our panelists, go to newmexicoinfocus.org.